Hello and a very happy 2014 to you. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And in 1994, there was a groundbreaking study showing that college athletes make up 3.3% of male students, but 19% of those accused of sexual assault. Jeff Benedict, one of the authors of the study, said, "Does this study say participation in college sports causes this? Clearly, no, we're not saying that. We just think that at some point there is an association between sports and sexual assault. The farther you go up, the more entitlements there are, and one of those entitlements is women." Joining us this hour to talk about this issue, and there have been many instances of sexual assault charges and convictions the last few years, 20 years after the aforementioned study, the problem is still very much front and center. Laura Finley is our guest, assistant professor of sociology and criminology at Barry University. She does a great deal of teaching and research in criminal justice, sociology of violence, elite and organized crime, and perspective consciousness and social justice. She serves with several nonprofits to provide services to victims of domestic violence and essential human rights. We'll be welcoming phone calls. We have a lot of cases that we'll be discussing, and the issue is a complicated issue and a very serious issue in American society where we glorify people who are at the top of the sports world. And are they, I guess, is the question. Is there an association between sports and sexual assault? We welcome your phone calls during the course of the hour, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you would like to go there and leave a message, we love to read Facebook. At least I do, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Laura Finney, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's interesting. I mentioned that study that was done, and you've mentioned it in several articles you've written, in 1994. It doesn't appear that things are much better 20 years later, does it?
No, it really doesn't, in particular if we allow, you know, national news to tell us about these cases. It certainly seems like this is a problem that's, if anything, worsened. Statistics are always hard to come by. I think Jeff Benedict's work has been amazing on this topic. Other researchers, though, have verified very similar numbers. And so, again, yeah, it doesn't look like the problem has gotten a lot better, unfortunately.
When he said the farther you go up, the more entitlements there are, and one of those entitlements is women, would you agree with that? And what does that mean, your entitlement is a woman?
Well, I think we have to be really careful because I think sometimes we often want to paint with a really wide brush on these kinds of issues and come across anyways as if we're suggesting that all high-level athletes are and feel a sense of entitlement or all high-level athletes are more likely to, you know, sexually assault a woman. And I think we have to be really careful of that. While the statistics are what they are, and I do believe there is sometimes a sense of entitlement, I always like to be cautious because I think we alienate some of our crowd sometimes when we speak as
sure.
If, you know, this is a problem for all athletes. What research seems to suggest is there are certain types of sports in which athletes are overrepresented as assailants in sexual assault cases, as well as perpetrators in domestic violence cases. Those tend to be what they call the power and performance sports, things like football, high-level basketball, hockey, wrestling, boxing. That same trend does not seem to hold true for the more individualized sports. For instance, swimming, running, tennis. And so I think that's a really important point to make, too. So we're not looking at all college or professional athletes. We're actually looking at a certain type of athlete. I think within those kinds of sports, there is such an idolatry in the United States of those athletes, in particular the ones that can perform at such a high level, that I think that can come with that sense of entitlement. And I think sometimes universities and professional sport organizations actually encourage that through maybe inadvertently, maybe purposely, that's hard to know, through some of the things they do. For instance, when I was a college athlete at Western Michigan University, they were actually starting a program as I was leaving, the Bronco Bells, and they were going to be a team of girls who were going to usher around on tours and make nice visits for prospective athletes. Well, this doesn't make anyone sexually assault anyone, obviously.
Right.
I think it sets a tone that these male athletes are entitled to this treatment, and it is women who serve them in that way. Mm-hmm. As a collegiate athlete, I didn't have any young bevy of men showing me around campus, you know. So I think that sometimes universities and, again, professional sports really reinforce that idea. And, of course, the fans do it mm-hmm. by paying tons of money for tickets and merchandise and going to games and, you know, going crazy when their teams win. And so I think that is a part of the issue for sure.
And as it has been true in other institutions, the Catholic Church, of course, is a case in point over the last few years. There tends to be, in many of these cases, the Steubenville, Ohio trial this year, which was a horrendous case of high school football stars who were convicted. But the cover-up that goes with this and the blaming the victim and the ostracizing that happens in students who have to drop out of school, there really is a culture that either turns a blind eye to this or does not want to believe that their star athletes can do this. This is a pattern that seems to be exhibited over and over again.
Absolutely. I mean, just in October, seven women at University of Connecticut filed a Title IX complaint saying that the university failed to respond to reported sexual assault, some by athletes, some by other people, but nonetheless a failure to respond. Young lady at Notre Dame a couple years ago committed suicide after her school failed to respond to an allegation that a football player sexually assaulted her. 2012, the U.S. Department of Justice is investigating the University of Montana for 11 sexual assaults within an 18-month period, ooh, allegedly perpetrated by athletes, and again, the university's failure to actually do what they're required to do, which is to report those under the Dean Cleary Act, as well as to fully investigate and hold accountable if their investigation results in anything. And so I think that is a huge piece of it. I think it's as you said, you know, people don't want to believe their stars can do these things. They often, if anyone's read Jeff Benedict's books, oftentimes the women who accuse athletes are essentially assaulted by the athlete's teammates or supporters, not necessarily physically, but verbally harassed to drop charges or to not press charges. Even in some cases, Benedict reports of coaches intervening and, you know, kind of coercively telling women don't pursue this. That's a major problem. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes in these cases, there is some degree of substance use involved, not always, but many times. And I find that on a college campus, that complicates the matter a lot because sometimes victims say, well, geez, then my behaviors, which may also potentially have been illegal, are going to be under scrutiny, not to mention the whole rape culture and rape myths and victim blaming that is so endemic. And so I think it becomes easier to be coerced not to report, not to pursue, than to go forward in such a, you know, a difficult climate.
Are there a lot of universities and colleges in this country, and high schools for that matter, who have taken all of these cases to heart and have decided that they need very strong education programs that talk about this very issue, that try to hold athletes to the highest of standards?
I believe there are a lot of that have done that, and I think there are a lot of athletic departments at all those levels that have said, we want to be the anti-example. We want to be the ones who step out and say, this is not okay, and this is not the culture we want. I know at my university, Barry University in Miami Shores, Florida, it's a small Catholic liberal arts school, but we have a very active athletic department, and they are very eager to, you know, have more training on these issues, to reach the student body. We have a big month in February, which is Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month, and we do a lot of work on domestic dating violence and sexual assault, and our athletes are a huge part of that. And so, you know, I think that's a really important point, too, that there are places they're trying to reject that and to be proactive. I know for years even the National Football League required rookie players to have training on issues related to these things. Now, obviously, that's not going to be – well, one-time training isn't going to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. However, it is a step in the right direction. There's also some really good programs that are really tailored to reaching – men in particular, but also athletes. One of them is Jackson Katz's Mentors in Violence Prevention Program, MVP, which he has utilized in military, in athletic groups, in a variety of groups that are sort of male-dominated. And it's really a bystander intervention program where people are presented to as if they are not would-be assailants or would-be victims, but really as if they're part of the solution, and at some point they may be a bystander in a situation that makes them uncomfortable, and how can we empower them to speak up and to reach their peers and say, it's not okay what you're saying or doing with this young lady or with this young man or in this relationship. So there are a lot of really good programs and groups working on this. I think, though, it's a bigger problem than just athletics. I think it's a problem of how, as a culture, we talk about rape and sexual assault still, and how we craft sort of gender role norms and a number of sort of sociological phenomena that are really related to it.
And you wrote at least three students each semester since you started teaching who have come to you and confided to you about experiencing an attempted or actual sexual assault on your campus.
Yeah. And unfortunately, those students tend not to report it through official lines like our public safety department or like through our counseling center, which would be private, but at the same time is a more administrative, you know, way of reporting than to reach out to a professor that you feel comfortable with. Most times the students don't want that kind of intervention. What they've said to me anyways is, I don't like what's happened or is still happening in some cases, but I don't want to get criminal justice or the courts or anything official involved because that will create even more difficulties in my life. And sometimes they just don't want that for the perpetrator either. Mm-hmm. These are people sometimes they've had relationships with and they say, I just want them to stop. I don't want their life ruined through a, you know, criminal justice conviction. And you know, as a advocate, I have to respect that and say, okay, what you want is what should matter most.
We were talking about prevention programs. Some have said that campus sexual assault prevention programs are putting too much of the onus for change on the victims, telling females, you know, you shouldn't walk by yourself, you shouldn't accept drinks from a stranger, you shouldn't drink too much, be sure you do not dress provocatively.
I think that's often the case because it's the easiest way to do it. And while, of course, we can all be taught to sort of be safer, I guess, that's a sort of insidious way of victim blaming. And I find it very troublesome. I think it's an easy way out. It's a dodge. Instead of bringing really extensive programming and really on your campus or you're in your community trying to address what is it that makes people feel that they're entitled to have sexual relations with someone who does not want it, instead of having that difficult conversation, we do things that are simple sometimes. That brings up, I think, to me, a bigger issue sort of general rape myths, as they're called in the literature, this idea that we have, as a culture, a lot of misconceptions about rape and sexual assault related to what victims look like, act like, and do, but also related to what perpetrators look like, act like, and do, and that those myths are so widespread. They're in our popular culture. They're in the way that the media talks oftentimes about these kinds of issues, and they're very insidious, and so even victims start to internalize some of those myths and misconceptions and don't receive the help that they require because they don't report or don't go to get that help because they believe somehow they're at fault. They've been told that through, you know, again, all these sort of myths and misconceptions.
Mm-hmm. What do you make of the Jameis Winston case, the Heisman Trophy winner who was accused of rape? The charges were not brought against him because the DA said there wasn't enough evidence, and yet there were some questions about this case because, from my reading, the Tallahassee Police Department kind of sat on the evidence for perhaps too long a time.
Right. And that would be my reading, too. I wish things would have moved faster. It may well be that there, at the end of the day, is insufficient evidence. And, you know, sometimes that is the case in these situations. But sitting on the evidence seems very dodgy, as does a lot of the handling of it. I mean, when the state attorney, William Eggs, is kind of smirking and giggling when he makes the announcement, this does not necessarily go over well, even if the announcement is the best you can do at this point. I like, as one source of information, some really interesting articles about this. A website called Jezebel has some great stuff. And one of their articles, they talk about, we need to be reminded that insufficient evidence does not mean it was a false claim. It means exactly what it says, that they don't have enough that they feel like they can win a case. And so I think as a culture, we have to be careful to say that doesn't necessarily mean nothing happened. We don't know what happened, and we won't know what happened. And so not to, you know, tally this up to this was a woman out seeking something or other like we often do, but rather just to say that we need, as a criminal justice system, a little bit better way of handling this stuff.
Yeah. I shouldn't do this, but you can't help yourself. Sometimes I was reading some of the comments on that case. You know, you have a newspaper article and people write these comments, and usually they're outrageous. But I thought it was telling that so many of the comments really took aim at this young woman, calling her a slut and saying, I wish I had somebody like her. She had a reputation. She had men all the time, on and on, one comment after another.
Right. Yeah. And that's unfortunately not uncommon. It's actually the reason why, you know, the last couple of years, this slut walk movement has gained a lot of steam, where women and their male allies across the country and even across the globe are saying, we got to take that back. There is no such thing as you got raped because you're a slut.
Right.
There is such thing as somebody decided to rape you. I'm looking at one right now on my computer, and it was from NBC Sports Radio. It says, confirmed, Jameis Winston gives the Heisman the stiff arm to the gives the Heisman stiff arm to the allegations against him of sexual assault. Hmm. Just the kind of that whole language, mm-hmm, of like, ha ha, you know, we won. He didn't win in this case either. You know, I mean, if nothing happened, I'm glad he wasn't charged, but his name was all over the media in these ways. Nobody wins when we don't do a good job of investigating claims of sexual assault.
We'll start taking phone calls in a moment. Our lines are all filled. Laura Finley is our guest. Laura is an assistant professor of sociology and criminology at Barry University in Florida, has written extensively about sports and sexual assault, and that's what we are talking about this hour. I guess the overall question is there a connective tissue between a jock culture and a rape culture? There have been so many highly publicized accusations and trials and convictions during the course of the past year and in recent years, even though we have known since 1994, when a major study was done on this, that college athletes make up 19%, 3.3% of male students, but 19% of those accused of sexual assault. So what do you think? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email, you can leave messages there, is talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Two phone calls now. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our guest is Professor Laura Finley, Assistant Professor of Sociology and Criminology at Barry University. And we start our calls with Chris in Wisconsin Dells. Hi, Chris.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Chris.
Hi. Thank you for the show. I have to apologize. I'm talking past my sinuses. I've got the plague that's going around. I have to give you just a little disclaimer at the top of this. I lost my entire life because I reported a department full of sexual predators to the University of Wisconsin system. And so I have been watching that system for the past 25, 30 years with respect to this kind of stuff. And I wanted to say a couple of things. Number one, the authorities are in cahoots with these people, and I have a little bit of information for you just to explain what happens. As you know, those of your listeners that don't know this, the University of Wisconsin Marching Band was brought up on charges of hazing women into the band by making them perform sex acts with the male members of the band. And I found out because I ran into a guy whose sister had been in the band just when Title IX came into effect and they had to let women in the band in 1972. And he said that this was going on for that entire period of time and that they were brought up on a second set of charges because they didn't do anything about it. And they allowed the band was suspended for one game, I guess, and then they just slapped everybody's hand. There was a Wisconsin legislative audit hearing, and I appeared at that hearing. I was the only citizen in the state of Wisconsin who testified about this stuff. People don't care. What they care about is whether or not these sexual predators are going to win the Rose Bowl for them. And it's very, very sad. And I have watched these sexual predators go in front of the authorities in Dane County repeatedly, and the district attorney just simply slaps their hand and says, go play the Rose Bowl, little boy. And there has to be, like, a hue and outcry by the citizenry to do something about this.
When did you testify, Chris? What year did you testify?
This was about 5 years ago. Oh, the other thing I wanted to say is that when that audit came out, because this was the audit hearing, mm-hmm. when that audit came out, there was not one word in the audit about what was going on. Not one word. It was all just pablum around the edges. And I went spoke to the woman who had been the assistant to my state representative when we asked for our audit. And she said, what part of this surprises you? That the whole state of Wisconsin is in cahoots to protect these people, and there's nothing you can do. And so people who are, I mean, I lost my entire life.
Professor Finley, are you familiar with this?
I'm not this particular incident at University of Wisconsin, and I'm really sorry to hear that you had to deal with this. Chris, this sounds awful, but it doesn't sound surprising, unfortunately, either, because it's the kind of thing that's happening in lots of these cases where, you know, the victim does report to somebody and is hush-hushed, or there is a slap on the wrist like you described in this case, but not nearly enough for the what you had to deal with and what maybe many other women had to deal with. We've had our own issues with sexual-related hazing down here in Florida as well, and I think you're right on, Chris, that it does require that public outcry, because until more people understand this and say, I care about this more than whether my team wins, we can't make that change. And so I'm happy we're talking about this on the show. I'm happy for work like Jeff Benedict's and others who say, I'm a sport fan. Personally, I am a sport fan, too. I'm an athlete. But it doesn't have to be this way. We don't have to glorify athletics in these ways that say you have a free pass to do whatever you want. But I think we just need more. We need a critical mass of people saying that same thing.
See, it's hard for me to believe that she would discover this was going on and raise questions about it and testify. And there wouldn't be, in the whole state of Wisconsin, more of an outcry. I remember this story, not great details about it, but that there wouldn't be a lot of people of goodwill who would stand up and say, we just can't have this. I mean, we have a reputation to uphold. This is a fine university.
Yeah, it is almost shocking that more people don't step up. I think part of it is there's a significant population, a proportion in the population that have been victims or have been victims of an attempted sexual assault. And many times those people have a hard time speaking out, not all, but some, because it's so raw and so difficult for them. And we're talking on campuses, a quarter of women endure an actual or attempted rape, and in the general population, it's more like one in six. So that might be one facet. It's just so raw and so difficult. I think there's the other issue of, again, our idolatry of these athletes and how much people tie their identity into their sport teams, you know, even sometimes teams that they weren't even part of or didn't even go to that university or you know, have any real connection to. And a lot of it is just, again, that I think that rape myth thing, the general belief in the public that women are more likely to lie or falsely accuse somebody of sexual assault than of another crime, when in actuality, research by the FBI and various other scholarly studies show that false accusations of rape and sexual assault are very low, lower than most crimes. And actually, 2-5%, they estimate, are false. So we're talking about, yes, that does happen. We have mm-hmm. to admit that does happen. But the bigger issue is the underreport. You know, but I think when the general public believes that this is going to be false, this is somebody out to get attention or to, you know, to get money from an athlete right. or, you know, whatever, they aren't going to take it up as their sort of banner and go to these kinds of hearings that Chris was describing mm-hmm. or make this an issue.
Send us more. Chris, thank you. We have a ton of phone calls, but send us more information. You can leave reports or whatever on our Facebook page. We'd be interested in hearing more about that. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and thank you very much for calling. I hope you feel better soon. Colin in Madison, hi.
Yeah, hi. I heard the evidence that that six times as many athletes are reported alleged of sexual assault. But I'm wondering if maybe athletes just happen to have six times as much sex. with six times as many women, and then in which case it would kind of make sense that they got reported the same amount. They just had more people to report them.
It's an interesting thought. You know, it's certainly there's some great work on sort of the hookup culture, in particular on campuses, but also among, you know, high-profile athletes. And so there's certainly I wouldn't be in any position to deny that that's possible, that these folks are having more sexual relations with more partners. That's certainly quite possible. However, we have to be careful of that. It kind of presumes to me anyways, as I hear it, it presumes that because there may be more partners, they may be more likely to falsely accuse. Simply
right.
More partners wouldn't mean you have any entitlement to sexually assault those partners. Hopefully that's consensual sex with multiple partners, if that's what it is. So I don't know if I heard you right, but I think we just have to be cautious of that. But I think what you're suggesting, that there could be this sort of hookup culture, could be an important piece of the puzzle as well. And maybe that's something that needs to be part of the solution, is how do we address that sense of, you know, it's a good idea to, if you're an athlete, to have multiple partners. Interesting, related to what you're talking about, too, and again, this is why I think we have to be really careful when we talk about this, not painting with too broad a brush, but some of the same studies that found these higher rates of accusations against athletes didn't find higher conviction rates. In the general population, they found, for instance, 80% of sexual assault cases result in a conviction, whereas athletes were convicted in only 38%.
Oh, that's interesting. Really?
Yeah. So this might tell us a couple things. It could tell us, for instance, that evidence wasn't clear, as in the Jameis Winston case, or it was a flat-out false report, which we know has happened. The Duke lacrosse case is a good example. It could also tell us that there's been some kind of cover-up or manipulation, and so it doesn't get that far to, you know, get to a conviction. It could also tell us, in the case of very high-profile athletes in particular, you know, NFL, NBA, you know, hockey, these sports that have a lot of financial resources, that they're able to have better justice than would be the general population. So it's not clear what exactly that tells us, but it's an important thing to keep in mind, I think, when you think of the whole equation.
Thanks very much for the call, Colin. Somewhere I read a suggestion of how to change this, and I'm wondering if you think this would make any difference at all, was to have more women in athletic departments as trainers, as, you know, more coaches of some of these teams, instead of just wearing, as many of them do, kind of scantily clad cheerleader costumes.
I think that would definitely help, in the sense that it would be a more normalized seeing women in different kinds of positions, not as, like you said, a cheerleader role, or not as the groupie kind of role, but as powerful women who have something to do with your success, not as something you're entitled to. They're helping you along the way. I think that would be a very, very great idea. Unfortunately, this is one of the things that Title IX was supposed to have done, was increase the number of coaching positions for women. And in actuality, I'm not a Title IX expert, but my understanding is it didn't do that. It opened up new sport opportunities for women, but actually we have more male coaches of some of those even female sports. And so I think that would be a really interesting – it would be interesting to see some empirical studies, I guess, if that was a really big piece of the solution. But I would suggest that that seems logical, and it certainly couldn't hurt to see more, you know, powerful women.
Our number is 800-486-8655, and we have a couple lines available right now. We're talking about college athletes, it goes to high school athletes these days, too, with some really celebrated and very disturbing cases. High school football players convicted of raping a 16-year-old girl in Steubenville, Ohio, this year. But we're looking at the number of incidents, and there have been many of them in college. Many, many colleges have had sexual assault charges brought against particularly football players, and we're looking to see if there's some kind of connection between that culture that we worship football players particularly. There's kind of a machismo about them, tough, and whether or not there is a sense of entitlement, and that entitlement means women, and it leads to kind of a connection between a jock culture and a rape culture. That's our conversation this hour. 800-486-8655 is the number. Email talk@wpr.org. Mike in Milwaukee, hello.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to mention that this issue is complicated by mercenary women who involve themselves sexually with these athletes with the hope of obtaining a hush money payoff from the university or from the athlete. Moreover, the NBA and NFL hold workshops on this issue for the rookie athletes to alert them to these mercenary women who make false sexual charges or seek to become pregnant by professional athletes for the exorbitant child support granted by the courts. I'll take any responses off the air.
Professor?
Yeah, things are breaking up just a little bit, but I think I got the gist of that. The comment was related to women who may go after a high-profile athlete to get money, to get pregnant, for child support, et cetera. I can't deny that that has happened ever because that would be silly and it's disingenuous. However, the bulk of women don't do this. The bulk of people, and not even just women, don't do this. Again, the false reports of sexual assault are 2 to 5%. That's lower than almost every crime except for minor larceny. That's lower than most major, you know, violent crimes. Do people do this? Yes, again, maybe, but I think that just misses a lot of the point of the bigger issue is the underreport of sexual assaults. You know, again, according to studies and data collected by the FBI, some 55% of sexual assaults go unreported. So to me, that's just a bigger issue than if on occasion somebody did do what was described by the caller. If it is found that somebody did falsely report, then there are legal systems in place to deal with that as well. Issues of perjury can come out, you know, various legal ways to address that. I want us to be so cautious of suggesting that that's a major factor. I think oftentimes people presume that when the data is not entirely clear of that. Case in point is Mike Tyson. A lot of people, you know, looked at the case when Mike Tyson was convicted of rape. Oh, she went up to his room with him. She didn't wear any panties when she did it, and this must mean that it was consensual sex. That's a lot of this must mean assumptions instead of us knowing really clearly what happened there. So I guess I would just be really cautious of what the caller suggested.
And what did you think of Mike's comment? I've never heard this before, that the NBA, he said, and the NFL both conduct workshops for their athletes on being careful of mercenary women. Is that true?
You know, not to my knowledge. I know that the NFL and the NBA, to some degree, have done workshops on understanding these phenomena, dating and domestic violence in particular, because I've actually led some of those down here for the Miami Dolphins a couple times. Mm. But I was not aware that was something that they overtly trained their athletes on. Now, would it be something they would informally do? I don't know. That's quite possible that they might say, hey, be on the lookout because there could be people who are going to take advantage of you in a variety of ways. In fact, that would probably be smart in the sense of don't let people take advantage of you because of your now high profile, your now financial, you know, situation, your new status. But that wouldn't necessarily have to relate to just sexual assault. That could be relating to all kinds of phenomena where people might want to take advantage of somebody who's now wealthy and famous. But I don't know that they do that particularly. The caller may be correct, but that's not something I'm aware of.
Phil in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right, Phil, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Happy New Year.
You too.
My question about coaching is, or my comment, is that Title IX has been around for a few decades now, and I think the coaches who are women who initially came on the scene were remarkable women who were pioneers. And they did not have the foundation of years of playing behind them that young women have had since Title IX. And now I think the expectation should be that there are more women coaches because you've had more women coming through the playing ranks who are familiar with the game, have grown up with the game, have played the games at different levels. You know, I know even way back when I was a kid, the coaches of the field hockey team were definitely women because women played field hockey. Now, since we've had that whole evolution of player to potential mentor, we should be seeing a lot more women coaches.
And I agree, we should be, and that would be fantastic if we were. And I admit I'm not a super expert on Title IX, so I don't want to overreach my knowledge level here. But my understanding is we aren't seeing what might be expected, and part of that obviously is related to maybe who does the hiring. You know, while there may be women who are interested in more coaching positions, if the hiring is still done in such a way that it perhaps privileges a male candidate, then it might still result in there being more men getting some of those positions. I guess that's the best explanation I could think of for why the data doesn't seem to suggest what you would think would be logical, which is what you presented to us.
Go ahead, Phil. We couldn't hear what you just said.
Yeah, I guess there's a comfort level. You always tend to hire a person you're most comfortable with, be it, you know, a person who graduated the same university as you or somebody else you have something in common with.
Right.
There's also the economic pressure. You know, the programs have to be successful in a lot of cases, so I'm sure that weighs into it as well. But I guess my point is the excuses are fewer. In terms of the rape charges and the liberties that some athletes seem to think are theirs by right, I think there's probably a culture of entitlement there that we cultivate. But I also think the media should be more responsible when there are these incidents to be hard on the heroes who, are not really heroes. I think Kobe Bryant is a perfect example of that.
Mm-hmm. I forgot about that.
We can be really hard on OJ. We can be really hard on Mike Tyson, but we're glorifying Kobe Bryant now. And, you know, he was, I think, and probably the situation was very parallel to Mike Tyson, except for the fact that, you know, he was probably, what's the right word I'm looking here for? You know, he had a certain level of sophistication and education that Mike Tyson never had, so he should have known a lot better than Mike Tyson.
Mm-hmm. Well, he brings up an interesting area we haven't talked about, and that is media's response. As I was reading about this on internet articles, I found a substantial numbers of sports networks, you know, ESPN and sports writers writing for various publications who are concerned about this issue. Is it something that sports publications particularly and the mainstream media ignores, or do you think that they are serious about reporting these kinds of accusations and these convictions in a serious fashion?
I think it's just a real mixed bag. I think that there are some that really are dedicated to doing a really good job of this, to not victim blaming, to not, you know, even in those very covert or difficult ways of victim blaming that come out, even some things like using the passive voice instead of the active voice, which has been studied over and over again, and it allows people to believe the victim being more responsible than he or she really is. And, you know, I think there are some that are really devoted to being careful about that stuff. And there are some really good guides out there for journalists who want to cover these kinds of issues. How do you cover it in a sensitive manner while still getting the importance of the story? But I think on the other side of the mixed bag, there are some that just really need a lot of work yet. One example I think that's really interesting is Jackson Katz, as a scholar, athlete, award-winning activist and filmmaker who's done a lot of work on these kinds of issues as well, and is in particular about engaging men and boys as allies in the efforts to end violence against women. And I think it was 2003, he and some other filmmakers made a documentary video called Wrestling with Manhood, in which they zeroed in on World Wrestling Entertainment. And just as one source, not as the only or the primary or anything like that, but just, you know, as one source of storylines in pop culture and in media about violence against women. And what they show is that in the sport, there are all these storylines that suggest that women have it coming, and she cheated on him, so she deserves this, or they're all sluts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is just, again, one example. I don't mean to demonize wrestling. I'm just drawing that up because it was a really well-done documentary in which we as a public see this stuff. And who watches World Wrestling? Well, the demographics skew very heavily to young boys and men. And so if you're feeding them through this sport that they like, the storyline that women are going to come after you and they're just in it, you know, they're greedy and they're, you know, it's their fault for whatever happens to them, it's not shocking that, you know, people in the general public kind of believe that, too.
Yeah. More phone calls momentarily. We want to pay a little bit of attention to what happened in March of this year, Congress passing a Campus Sexual Violence Elimination Act. We'll talk about that and if that's a meaningful piece of legislation in trying to take on this very large and complicated issue. And we'll welcome more of your phone calls. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Leave comments online talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and our guest is Laura Finley, Assistant Professor of Sociology and Criminology at Barry University, who has studied this issue extensively and written about it extensively as well. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to an email from Christy. Your guest and callers seem to be suggesting that more women as coaches, trainers would make a change in the attitude of athletes. My experience as a high school teacher in rural Wisconsin was that the female athletes were just as likely as the male athletes to take advantage of their status and use it to gain privileges. This may not translate into sexual assault in the case of females, but I believe the root problem is learning that you won't be held accountable if you're an athlete and learning it early.
I think that's an important observation, too. And I think she's probably right on that when we privilege athletics in any particular community, culture, school setting, whatever, you know, institutional parameters we're putting around it, that female athletes may take advantage of that status as well. As she notes, that's likely not in terms of sexual assault quite so much because that tends not to go that way. I think it's an important reminder that we are giving people an awful lot of entitlement, but we don't have to. There are campuses, there are communities, there are school cultures in which athletes are acknowledged for what they do. They're honored for what they do, but no more so than other places. So it's quite possible to create a culture in which that status entitlement doesn't happen. You know, we see examples all over the place of that as well. I like the reminder from the emailer,
right?
You know, that anyone taking advantage of their status is not okay. You know, when we talk about sexual assault specifically, it's not just high-level athletes that are overrepresented. You know, military has been receiving
yes.
a lot of attention.
Yes.
Police are overrepresented in accusations of domestic violence. What do these all have in common? They're male-dominated areas in which there's sort of gender role norming that is very sort of hyper-aggressive, risk-taking, power and control. And so, you know, I think these are all really important reminders as we try to piece together what's the right way to deal with this and to go forward so that we prevent this from happening. We have to think of all those parts of the puzzle.
And when there's a lot of money involved in it, as there certainly is in professional sports and college sports for that matter, universities depend on their athletic departments and teams that are doing very well to run other departments in the university. We place so much importance. It's hard to change that.
It is, and you know, and it's also a lot of the data isn't obvious or widely disseminated to the public. Like, for instance, there are campuses in which the athletic departments, you know, the football team does help sort of finance the rest of the athletic department or that kind of model. But in a lot of places, that's actually not true, but we think that it's true because we see the large dollars being made for bowl games and things like that, but we don't necessarily know how to pull back the layers and see where that all goes. And so I think there are a lot of misconceptions around some of those things that happen too. And as a general public, if we don't have access to that data or don't know easily how to find it, we may easily fall into some presumptions about, you know, what's happening on any of these fronts.
Yeah. Tell me about this Sexual Violence Elimination Act, what Congress did last year, and how important it is to taking on the subject that we've been talking about.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely from a symbolic level, first off, it's very important because anytime I think we pass legislation at the federal level, it's a recognition that this is a really important issue that needs to be addressed. And so at layer one, I think that's already good. In essence, what it does is it requires post-secondary institutions that participate in Title IX funding, financial aid from Title IX to compile some statistics related to domestic violence, dating violence, sexual assault, and stalking, to publish those with their annual security reports, to take measures to educate the campus about those issues through primary prevention programs, to have procedures in place to deal with an incident when it is reported, in regards to all kinds of efforts like preserving evidence, who should be it reported to, how should other law enforcement be notified if they are, how to conduct investigations. So the law is, I think, fairly thorough in the multiple pieces of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it does require kind of a rule or policy and consequence piece, but importantly also requires education. And that's where the real change is obviously going to happen around creating those campuses, that this is not even something we have to talk about anymore. Mm-hmm. And that will come with not just one-off, one-time presenters about sexual assault. You have to go to a seminar once in the fall and call it a day. But I think what the spirit of the law is saying is it has to be much more detailed than that. It has to be an ongoing, year-round effort on your campus
mm-hmm.
to create a norm where, you know, women or men, where no one is undervalued in a way that allows them to, you know, potentially be a victim of sexual assault.
Tim in Fairchild, next caller. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I'm wondering where these fall on a spectrum. What I mean by that is if you get too intoxicated, you're not able to consent. If someone has sex with you, that's sexual assault. You know, it runs the gamut everywhere from something like that happening, which I can see happening on a college campus, to something where, you know, a forcible with a weapon, absolutely brutal rape. You know, and obviously we can't lump all of these together. Somebody is still being assaulted in all of them. But I'm wondering if there's any information in the numbers that points to, are we seeing more of one than the other? And is it something where people are even aware that if the girl is too drunk and you're drunk, that it's assault? Because I know that was brought up. I go to school in the area, and that was brought up at our school, and there were some people who kind of scoffed at the fact that if two people are drunk and one is more drunk, the one who is more drunk is less able to consent.
Right. That's a really important observation, because what most of the research says on sexual assault on campuses in particular and involving athletes as perpetrators is that it is more of that nature. It's it's an acquaintance situation to some degree, typically, and oftentimes alcohol or other drugs are involved. It tends not to be as much of the held down with a weapon form. Now, I don't want to dismiss that that has happened, of course, but it tends to be more of the former. And I think you're exactly right in the sense that a lot of people don't really fully understand what it means to consent or to deny consent for sexual relations, and that being drunk, you cannot consent, absolutely. And the consent has to be affirmative. You have to affirmatively say, I consent to this, rather than a presumption of consent and you didn't take it back, if that makes sense. I think people just are really not clear on what that consent piece means, and it does get, as you say, more murky when you talk about intoxication. I think that's why a lot of campuses are really trying to not necessarily couple the two, because I think it's dangerous to completely couple the two and suggest all sexual assaults are the result of intoxication, but to at least draw attention to the ways that if there is sexual intercourse and there's alcohol involved, how might that play out, and you know, what are some of the unique facets. So I think campuses are aware that that's kind of what the statistics show us, and hopefully working in, and hopefully with this new law, that will require them to do even more to address that.
Thank you very much, Tim, for the call. And thank you, Professor Finley, for being with us. It was It's an important area, isn't it? It's something we don't talk about very much in terms of we hear about the incidents, but we never hear about what action needs to take place. And we've been talking about it for so long.
Yes, absolutely. And thankfully, there are some good, like we said, good organizations, good institutions, good models out there.
Mm-hmm.
So folks who are listening, hopefully, who are saying, wow, I really want to do more about this, they don't have to look too hard to find really good programs that we mentioned a few. And, you know, if anyone wants to follow up, happy to, you know, send folks articles or directions
great.
To websites that really give a lot of great resources for groups that want to do better.
Great. Thank you. We'll give your email address on our Facebook page. And, of course, there's always the issue of teaching your children and teaching your children well. Laura Finley, our guest this hour, assistant professor of sociology and criminology at Barry University in Florida, and we thank her for her time. Thanks, everybody, for all of your calls and for your emails. Our Facebook page, she said that she would leave suggestions, and we'll track those down, and you can send her information as well, so that will be on our page as the day goes on. Okay. Okay. Thanks very much to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing the hour, and to Lisa Nalbandian for production help as well.